Guess I'd better come look, Emery, before I call the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department without a sheriff, he said to himself. Fletch realized there really was not much need for him to go look. The mess in the gully was Juan Moreno, late of the federal penitentiary in Thomaston, Kentucky. Fletch had already seen him dead. He did not want to see him again. His training as a reporter made him go down through the house, leave his coffee cup in the kitchen, walk with Emery up the fields to the gully, peer down at what once had been relatively human. He could not report anything of which he was not immediately sure. "Guess I'm going to Chicago." When Carrie came into the study in her bathrobe, she was holding a cup of coffee to her lips as she walked. At the desk, Fletch was reading through a sheaf of faxes which had arrived from GCN and Andy Sist. There were several pages describing the clinical disorder of life-threatening obesity. There were two pages regarding Blythe Spirit, its founding, corporate structure, ownership, size, services offered, qualifications of senior staff, professional operating theory, licenses, etc. There was a one-page note from Andy saying that Mac was in hospital with a slipped disc, but Cindy and Roger would meet him at Chicago's O'Hare Airport shortly after noon. The administration and staff of Blythe Spirit would be delighted to see the crew from GCN whenever they arrived that afternoon and would do their best to prevail upon one or two patients to volunteer for interviews. When? Carrie drew her legs onto the couch under her. Leaving as soon as I get dressed. You're going to see Crystal. I thought she was out of pocket. I hope to see Crystal. Maybe she'll show you her son's postcards from Greece. Maybe. What if she does? I don't know. Carrie quoted Fletch. We're all mysteries awaiting solution, Fletch said. We're all histories awaiting execution. I don't know what else you can do, Carrie said. I mean, you've got to try to see Crystal soon as you can. Whatever else that kid is or isn't, he saved our lives last night as sure as God made bedbugs. I was awake much of the night. I must have turned 14 miles. I know. Fletch, I'm not sure what I heard, saw yesterday. All those wild-looking men together, their crazy eyes, their guns, the foul condition of the women and children. Those three guys O'Leary kindly run off after smashing two of their heads together. What I heard of that obscene speech. Mud people, children of Satan, Z-O-G. Chants of white rights have been ringing in my ears all night. Everybody throwing up. Did Jack really cause that with his electronic gimmicks? That violent dancing around the bonfire. Those stupid men bumping into each other like battery-operated toys, whacking each other over their heads. Seeing Sheriff Joe Rogers killed with a single stroke of that boy's hand. The cook hanging from the tree branch, his face all pooched out. Carrie's face did look as if it had spent the night in a pail of warm water. Pretty rough on you. You too, Fletch said. I'm still not sufficiently sure of anything. Maybe it's the bangs on the head I got. I still don't know why all this has happened, or what, if anything, to do about it. She said, I won't really know what I saw and heard until I know if Jack is really your son. Does that make sense? Fletch hesitated. I mean, she said, if Jack is your son, what is he doing with those people? Whoever he is, why did he lead us into this putrid mess? Isn't that what kids do? I've heard something like that from parents. Fletch picked up the phone. I've got to call the sheriff's department. I wish I could call Francie, Carrie said. Guess I'll have to wait. Maybe forever, Fletch said. Etna, how come you're working Sunday morning? The choir can't do without you.
Howdy, Mr. Fletcher. Everybody else seems just plumb wore out after all this excitement about those escaped convicts and all. Haven't heard gurgle or burp from the sheriff since sometime yesterday. He could be dead for all I know.
Fletch neither confirmed nor denied. Say, Etna, we have a dead body out here in the gully. Carrie's eyes popped.
You don't say?
I do. He's been there all day yesterday from the looks of him. His body is all swollen up. He's popped his shirt buttons and split the zipper on his jeans. Across the room, Carrie wrinkled her face and said, Ooh.
Do you suppose it's anyone we know, Fletch?
It's a good bet it's one of those escaped convicts you all have been looking for high and low.
The sheriff will be glad to hear that. The boys are sort of disappointed they didn't catch a single one. I'll call him before he gets dressed. He might want to run out and take a look before church.
You do that.
Is Carrie within hailing distance?
She's right here.
Let me speak to her, will you? I got that recipe for firecracker cake from Angie Kelly. I know Carrie wants real bad.
Handing over the mouthpiece, Fletch said to Carrie, Etna wants to talk to you. Firecracker cake.
Oh, good.
Carrie crossed the study and took the phone receiver.
Hi, Etna. How are you this morning?
Going upstairs to dress to go to Chicago, Fletch muttered, God, we'll never get rid of that damned body. Chapter 21.
Miami.
With a flourish, the Reverend Dr. Commandant Chris Kriegel unfolded a road map of the city of Miami, Florida, United States of America, on the square wooden table in the front room of the log cabin headquarters of the newly named Camp Orania in Tolliver, Alabama. The map covered the table. Commandant Wolf looked down at the map.
Miami?
Miami, Jack said. Phew. As Tracy looked down at the map, his face glowed. Shortly after 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, only the four stood around the cabin's table. They were meeting later than planned. Jack had awoken in time to set up the sound system for the Reverend Kriegel's religious service, prayer meeting, sermon, harangue, newly scheduled for 11 o'clock. As Jack put together the sound system, he saw the burial brigade, 7 men with long-handled shovels, return from the woods. They stood around him drinking water from the cabin's garden hose. He understood from the thirsty men they had dug one very big hole. They had dropped the hanged cook and the unexamined corpse of Joseph Rogers into the same hole with the shot and shredded remains of the bull calf. The Reverend Kriegel then had said a few words over the grave. To the men's amusement, he commented on the appropriateness of burying the cook cheek to jowl with roasted beef. Before Kriegel's 11 o'clock service, Jack again played martial music over the sound system, as Kriegel had ordered. After their party the night before, the members of the tribe were bleary-eyed and listless as they gathered for the sermon. Each holding a Bible, Commandants Wolf and Kriegel sat on camp chairs on the porch. Looking angelic, his eyes raised to the flag, Tracy introduced our Führer, the Reverend Dr. Commandant Chris Kriegel, whom lately God has released from the talons of the Zionist government. The congregation sitting on the ground muttered, I'll. A few raised their right hands to chest level.
That government, Kriegel began without preamble, which has committed treason against every true white citizen of these great United States.
White rights, the congregation rumbled.
Today, Kriegel announced, we are witnessing the beginnings of a great, new, worldwide revolution. Some might call it the reemergence of nationalism. It is the revolution of the tribes. We all shall rise and do glorious battle against each other. I tell you, my brothers, we must be ready to rise as a white nation. As every tribe, as every nation in this world is now doing, so must we purify ourselves, cleanse ourselves ethnically, rid ourselves of everyone who is not one of us.
At the electronic console, Jack inserted earplugs before putting on his earphones. Then he fiddled with some of the dials. To his regret, it was a very pregnant woman who began vomiting first, then 2 children. Very shortly, though, the men, all revelers the night before, were on their knees puking on the ground. They tried to beat each other, their own women and children, away from them with their arms as they crawled forward on their knees to give themselves room to vomit and breathe. On the porch, Tracy had disappeared again. Commandant Wolf had his hand on the screen door to the cabin when he doubled over and puked through the screen onto both sides of the door. His vomit dribbled down the door to the threshold. Preacher Kriegel vomited sideways onto the porch's floor. Holding their heads in their stomachs, people stood when they could and staggered away. They headed toward their trailers, their campers, their carport bunks. Several rolled onto the ground as soon as they reached shade. So, lunch was not desired, prepared, or served. Camp Orania fell into a retching silence. The meeting between Commandants Wolf and Kriegel did not commence until after 3 o'clock.
Do you trust him? Wolf glared at Jack as he entered the room for the meeting.
Oh, yes, Kriegel said.
Wolf growled, I don't think I do.
Jack smiled at him. Sure you do.
Jack is an answer to a prayer, Kriegel said. He hasn't been with me long, but it was Jack who organized my escape from prison.
Wolf said, my son is one thing.
And I'm another, right? Jack asked.
Jack's like a son to me, Kriegel said. Besides, you've seen his father.
That's one of the problems, Wolf said. His father has made no commitment to us, I'd say, from the things he said.
But he has, said Kriegel.
It was Jack's father who made my escape good. It was Jack's father who hid me out, who disguised me, got me through roadblocks, who got me here safely. I don't like the way that Fletcher guy talks. It's not what a man says, Kriegel said primly. It's what he does that counts. I think I'll look into all that, Wolf said. I have my own resources, you know. In exasperation, Kriegel boasted, Jack shot a cop, a woman cop. Well, all right, Wolf said. It was then that Kriegel unfolded the gasoline company's roadmap of the city of Miami on the table. Gentlemen, Kriegel said, be seated. They sat at the four sides of the table. Even though there are only two of us here, Kriegel said, with our lieutenants, this is a most significant meeting. It will go down in history. Therefore, I have asked Jack to record it. Jack took the small tape recorder out of his pocket and placed it on the roadmap of Miami. He turned it on. He'd had every intention of recording the meeting, asked or not. Tracy, Wolf said, take notes. Tracy was ready with his clipboard and pen.
Mine is a 3-point plan, Kriegel said, which plan, by way of stating our goal, I shall describe to you somewhat backward. Our goal is to drive the people from Miami.
What people? Wolf looked down at the map as if it offered information other than the names of roads. Why Miami? Kriegel asked. Haven't you ever heard Miami referred to as the capital of Latin America? Clearly Wolf hadn't. It's a mighty sprawly city.
Nearly all the people in it are aliens, Kriegel asserted.
Aliens? Tracy looked at the map, willing to see aliens. How do you intend to attack Miami? Wolf asked.
First by intelligence, Kriegel answered. Then by sabotage. Only then by force.
You mean to capture Miami? Wolf asked.
Oh, yes, Kriegel answered simply.
Capture and hold it?
Why not?
You're thinking of the armed might of the Zionist government of the United States, aren't you? I am giving it some thought, yes.
Once we have captured Miami, Kriegel said, the area will be flooded by white Americans eager to cast off the yoke of democracy, equality, and all that crap. We will fill up Florida like a boot. Our population will flood up the coast and west even as far as Texas, Colorado, and Nevada. Miami will be our capital.
Nice climate, Jack commented. Wolf said, you think big.
We will do this, Kriegel promised, and we will do this within 3 years.
But how? Where do we get the manpower?
Your organizations in this country report to me 30,000 registered members, and I at this moment command half the prison population in the United States. Have you any idea how many men that is?
Jack said, lots.
Besides, we are getting increasing numbers of followers among our student populations, our other unemployed. Oh yes, we have the manpower if we attract them, train them, and use them correctly. What we need are more and more training camps set up, using this marvelous Camp Orania you have established, Commandant Wolf, as a model.
Wolf tugged his shirt front down and squared his shoulders. Oh, yes, Commandant Wolf, Kriegel said. I see you becoming an increasingly important figure in this movement.
Tracy, glaring, grimaced at Jack.
Intelligence!
Kriegel looked at the roadmap of Miami.
We need to know where the electrical power grids are that service Miami. How to turn the city's water off, sabotage the sewers, sabotage the main bridges to the city, and blow them up at the appropriate moment.
There's the sea, Wolf said, studying the map diligently. The ocean.
Yes, Kriegel brushed that corner of the Atlantic Ocean with the back of his hand. I expect the aliens to escape by sea, back to Latin America and New York.
But they can ship food and water, troops into Miami by sea, Wolf pointed out.
There won't be time.
Sir, Tracy asked, how can we attack Miami if we've already blown up the bridges ourselves?
That's the charm of the idea, Kriegel admitted. Have you ever heard of a fifth column, the Trojan horse? Our troops will already be in the city. After the power and water are off, 36 hours, first we seize the airport. Then our troops will proceed block by block, driving the aliens toward the sea.
Phew, Jack said. They will drive the aliens toward the sea.
There won't be enough ships to take all the aliens away, Tracy said.
Then we drive the aliens into the sea.
Drive the aliens into the sea, Jack repeated.
Wolf asked his son, are you getting all this down, Tracy?
Oh, yes, sir.
Wolf sat back. Seems simple enough.
Tell me, Commandant Kriegel, how do we get the money for all this, for all the training we will need to do?
Lots of little Miamis, Kriegel said. We will establish a model.
Within 6 weeks, I should think, after you train your men for this specific task, Commandant Wolf, we will take just the men you have here, having chosen a small, fairly isolated city in the southwest, south, midwest, west, it doesn't matter. Gather intelligence on it, turn off its power and water, attack it in force, and liberate from that town's banks and other businesses what I think you Americans call cash money. Millions and millions of dollars of cash money. Wolf studied the matter.
Plundering. I like that idea. Will we try to hold these small cities?
No, Kriegel said. Just plunder them. You'll strike without warning, lock their police and other tiny town tyrants in their own jails, and make off overnight with every bit of cash and other valuables you can find.
Wolf slapped the table with the palm of his hand.
Excellent! I'm with you. The rest of my plan concerns you and me, my dear Commandant Wolf.
Don't you, my dear me, Wolf said quietly.
I intend to make my headquarters here, in this encampment, to which I have given the name Camp Orania.
You are most welcome.
Immediately, using whatever resources you have available, I shall need a handsome house built here for myself and personal staff, large and beautifully furnished, and air-conditioned, complete with swimming pool.
Wolf blanched.
Of course. We must have the prestige of leadership, you see.
Oh, certainly.
The membership, as it swells, won't respect us without. I will need here a Praetorian Guard, men loyal absolutely to me and my safety. I will need similar domiciles in other parts of the country, with safe and well-planned escape routes out of and into each.
Wolf blinked several times.
Come now, Kriegel said. Lieutenant Tracy has given me printouts of greetings from headquarters all over this great country and this great world. You must have my leadership. I insist things be done right. I shall have what I need.
Wolf considered this. Jack said, also the helicopters.
Yes, Kriegel said. Obviously, I will need to be transported in and out of these encampments around the country by long-range helicopters.
More than one?
Wolf asked. Kriegel said, they have so much downtime.
Also, he'll need at least one escort helicopter, Jack said.
Kriegel laughed.
Not to worry! He put his hand on Wolf's arm. You see why it is important to put my plans into effect immediately. First thing in the morning, you must begin training your men for our first plunder of a small city, to build up respect for us, to build up our membership, to build up our coffers, to give me the freedom to get around, meet with the other commandants, organize, for you to initiate training according to this plan, to work toward our goal.
Miami, Jack said.
Kriegel stood up. To Miami!
Tracy jumped up.
To Miami. One last thing, Kriegel said before leaving the room. Something must be done about the sanitation of this place. Every time I begin a speech, people throw up. It isn't the way the cook cooked. They hung him. It certainly isn't my speaking. It must be the water.
That's right, Jack mused. It must be the water.
Pardon me, sir. Are you Mr. Fletcher?
I am.
The young man, dressed entirely in white, said, "One of our patients, Miss Fayoni, has expressed a wish to meet you. Would you mind?"
Fletch smiled. "Not at all. Where is she?"
"In her room. She's been concentrating on her weight problem, but..."
The young man shrugged.
"Will you follow me, please?"
"Sure."
Fletch followed the young man through the corridors of Blythe Spirit's second floor. Fletch now knew the place had been built as the estate of a Wisconsin timber baron. Cindy and Roger had met Fletch at O'Hare International Airport at about 1:15. Together they had driven in the Global Cable News van, the 112 miles from Chicago to Forward, Wisconsin. Roger drove at first, while Cindy, who would do the on-camera work on the television feature describing Blythe Spirit's therapy for those suffering food addictions, studied the material faxed to Fletch on both the problems specific to food addiction and Blythe Spirit itself. Fletch had studied the material on the airplane from Nashville to Chicago. Together, in the back seat of the van, they worked on the script Fletch had drafted on the airplane. After Cindy had absorbed the material, she drove the van. She said driving relaxed her. They were warmly greeted by the staff of Blythe Spirit. Staying off camera, Fletch helped Roger set up the exterior shots. Once inside, he helped both Roger and Cindy set up the interview locations, helped those to be interviewed, administrators, staff, and two or three willing patients understand what was wanted from them, help Cindy and Roger understand what points in particular the interviewees wished to make. When Fletch was summoned to Crystal Fayoni's room, Cindy was just about to begin an interview with a patient in the sunroom on Bly's Spirit's second floor. There was little or no need for Fletch from that point forward. To get to Nashville Airport in time, Fletch had skipped breakfast. He had eaten an apple in the car. There was no time for him to eat anything at the airport. Nothing but drinks had been offered on the airplane. He had not wanted to delay Cindy and Roger at O'Hare Airport by stopping to eat. It was late afternoon. Fletch was very hungry. He did not know how to ask the staff of Bly's Spirit for food. As they approached the door to room 27, the young man in white slowed and spoke quietly to Fletch.
"If you can understand, sir, to ensure her privacy, Miss Fayoni has expressed the wish that she remain behind a curtain while she meets with you. You do understand, don't you?"
"A curtain?"
"Some of our patients are more sensitive about their condition than others are."
"Okay."
Fletch's stomach growled.
The room into which Fletch was shown was a perfectly pleasant bedroom. The king-sized bed and its side table were lower than usual. Two upholstered chairs had uncommonly wide seats. There were paintings of farm scenes on the beige walls. The outer wall was a sliding glass door onto a small balcony. The privacy curtain hanging from a rail around the bed had been run back. It pretty well concealed the space on the other side of the bed. The curtain was a white plastic, very like a shower curtain. Through the opaque curtain, backlit through the glass door, Fletch could see only the outline of a large bulk covered with white material. There was a globe on top of the bulk. The globe had neatly parted dark hair. It took Fletch a moment to realize he was seeing a seated figure, a person. From behind the curtain, a voice said,
"By my calculation, Fletch, it has taken you less than 48 hours since your first meeting, Jack, to find me and to penetrate my ultimate line of defense."
The voice was that of Crystal Fayoni. "Hello, Crystal. I wish I could say it's nice to see you."
"It really wouldn't be, you know."
"How did you know I was here?"
"I heard your voice. I watched you in the courtyard through the window."
"You still didn't have to invite me in for a visit."
"I had figured you would do something to get to me. I wasn't sure whether I would see you."
"You expected me?"
"I know you."
"Yes, you do."
"You arrived with a camera crew from Global Cable News."
"Yes."
"Clever. I'm sure the owners and administrators of Bly's Spirit are delighted by the publicity."
"They've been most cooperative. So why did you decide to invite me to your room?"
Once I saw you.
You were counting on that, weren't you?"
"You've changed little. Are you sitting?"
Fletch realized he had the advantage. She was backlit by the fading light in the window behind her. The attendant had closed the door behind Fletch. He could see her amazing outline. She couldn't see him at all.
"No."
"Sit down, please." The arms of the chair in which Fletch sat were too far away from his body to be useful. Could he have lost that much weight since that morning?
"Thank you. I seem to remember a time when you and I fell through a curtain very much like that one."
"I remember, too. We were wet, and we were naked, and it was wonderful. That reporter that came into the bathroom, what was her name, and found us on the floor struggling to get out from under that damned shower curtain? Freddie Arbuthnot, who I thought was an imposter. We were laughing. I was afraid you'd use her interrupting us as an excuse to stop."
"You didn't?"
"No, I didn't. She went away."
"You never were easily embarrassed."
"Is Jack my son?"
"What do you think?"
Various images went through Fletcher's mind. The back of the lanky young man dressed in wet, muddy prison denims in his study, looking away from him, the quick flash of his eyes. An hour later, finding him cleaned up in the study, as shiny as a new penny. His sitting in the morning sunlight on the top rail of the corral. His fiddling with the knobs of an electronic console in the dusk at Camp Orania. His crouching over the body of the man he had killed the night before. His repeating what Fletch said through the station wagon window just before Fletch left the encampment.
"Yes, he is."
People mark a certain physical resemblance. "Mental, too. He's as curious as a cat. In spirit, he's you all over again. Do you find him witty?"
"Witty?
Half."
"Do you like him?"
"Depends."
"You love him."
"Crystal, why didn't you ever tell me we have a son?"
How angry are you about that?
Very.
Why? It might have been nice, you know, son and dad, dad and son, birthdays, football.
Having a kid is a lot more than birthdays and football, Fletch.
Do you think me entirely irresponsible?
How many times have you been married? 3?
Yes.
Did you ever have kids with any of your wives?
You never really knew my wives. I mean, you did know me. We weren't grown up. I have no idea why I married Linda, Barbara.
You believed in the old institutions, you used to say.
Yeah.
In a time and place when you yourself were changing the old institutions more than you knew.
We all were.
Technology changed them more than anything we did. The bicycle, the car, radio, television, telephone, the computer, the pill.
Time and spatial relations, human relations were changing more and faster than ever before. We struggled to keep up. Most of us failed, I guess.
You never had kids with your wives, did you? So I should snatch a kid from you and surprise you with it? How would you have felt about that?
I might have liked it.
You married some East European princess. I read you called her Annie Maggie. Did you love her?
Yes.
Would you have had a child by her?
She was pregnant when she was assassinated.
I thought only we and one doctor knew about it. It may have been the reason she was assassinated.
Oh, God. Sorry, Fletch.
Life is long, life is short.
I did you a big favor, Fletch.
How's that?
If you had raised a son, he would have rebelled against you, dissented, probably become the opposite of everything you are and everything you stand for. Sons do that.
Some sons, I guess.
Your son would have.
I'm certain your son would have.
Not knowing you, Jack adores you.
Sure.
He does. He's enormously curious about you. He has scrapbooks of newspaper clippings about you. I had to consider putting him in therapy when Princess Annie Maggie was killed. He was that upset. He's read your book on Pinto, Edgar Arthur Tharp Jr., so many times I think he's worn out 12 copies.
Really?
I think he's memorized every line of it.
Fletch recollected the faddy little argument Jack had given him about Pinto.
Crystal said, "He insisted on going to your college."
"He went to Northwestern."
"Only because you went there."
"Crystal, you filled him up with silly stories about me."
"Sure, a mother who doesn't encourage respect for the father in her son loses a son.
Also loses the father. Some things never change. I told him stories about how many times and in how many ways you dodged picking up that bronze star. He pestered me for years trying to figure out how he could pick up your bronze star for you, get a hold of it. He probably will figure it out yet."
Fletch asked, "Whose name is on his birth certificate?"
"Yours."
"Oh, my."
Fletch wondered what would be the next thing he would eat and when.
"That's right."
"His name is John Fletcher Fayoni?"
"Yes."
"Who's John?"
"You wanted more of Irwin Maurice, maybe?"
"No.
There was no John. Don't be funny."
"Your office says John Fletcher Fayoni is spending the summer in Greece."
"He isn't. As you know, he is now at a camp in Alabama."
"Some camp?"
"Crystal, there never has been a John Fletcher Fayoni in any federal or state prison in the United States. We checked."
"Yes and no. No and yes. He was in the federal prison in Thomaston, Kentucky, 5 weeks, as a plant."
"A plant?"
"As soon as he escaped from the prison, all records of his having been there were to be expunged immediately."
"He never shot a cop or shot at a cop?"
"Of course not. Cop killing is one of the crimes that most impresses the tribe."
Fletch snorted. "Pink Cadillac convertible.